This is a production of Cornell University.
I now call this meeting to order at 4:35 p.m. Tuesday, November 27th. First order of business, we're going to approve the minutes for Tuesday, November 13th. Unfortunately, Randy have an addition to the minutes that he is not here to provide us with that information. So we will push the approval of the minutes to the next general meeting, which will be in January.
Do you know what those objections are?
The suggestion wasn't very concrete. It was that he had a question that didn't make it into the minutes, and that he wanted that particular question that he posed about the labs, et cetera.
Do you know what that is? Because I'd be happy to propose it as he wrote it.
Yeah, he really didn't provide any substantial. So we're going to have to work that out.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. He's just traveling, so I can't really pin him down.
All right, next order of business, we have Ulysses Smith from the Student Assembly. He is the Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion, and he have a presentation on the adoption of the Diversity Plan. Ulysses, you have the floor.
Thank you. As I said, I'm Ulysses Smith. I am the new Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion on the Student Assembly. And last 2 weeks ago, we had Resolution 41, which was an adoption of this plan, and I'm going to very, very briefly walk through, which is actually on the next plan. So, as AC Miller has alerted me, Student Assembly apparently is at the forefront of obligations and actually adopting a plan that we're fully addressing diversity head on. So what I'm here to show you or talk to you about what we've done and how it's going to help us be better representatives and more efficiently do our job and identify areas that we have traditionally been lacking in, and then hopefully encourage you all to, as a body, to create your own plan moving forward. So one of the biggest things that we really looked at before we came out with this plan was just what does it mean that we're not doing well? So we're talking about just outreach in general to particular constituencies. That was probably the big thing that we looked at as much, so in our community structures, the number of representatives that we had and exactly what their job to do. What do our bylaws say that we're supposed to be doing, and how well are we doing those, and how well are we actually in accordance with the university plan for the organization. So to reflect what every other unit across the university has done thus far, and that is selecting at least for 5 new items, one of them being composition, from the list of initiatives proposed for the destination, we actually did the same thing. That's actually what we're going to focus on in this particular meeting. So we did identify internal goals, that would be for the broader university and things that our new Student Assembly University Affairs Coalition could do. So the first portion of this is the composition piece of it. So that's the increased communication between these targets pipeline. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the data that's provided on the website based on our membership, the membership that is available, the information that RA puts up on the website over the past 2 years. We have people breaking that down demographically to see what races and ethnicities are represented, what is the gender breakdown. There are certain things we can't necessarily identify, such as sexual orientation and other unseen things. But we're going to look at what people are represented on the assembly itself and in our community structure. Based on that data, the people who we aren't reaching out to the most, we are going to make a concerted effort during our next community membership drive to make sure that we are reaching out, we're taking a physical presence to those communities and explaining what it is each of the assemblies does, how people can be involved, and making sure people understand why the assemblies are relevant to them, and how they can bring that to the policy changes. The other thing we looked at is broader university things that are programs that are already in place, so three freshman summer programs. For the past 2 years, the assembly has had a representative go during the summer to participate in the pre-freshman summer program and give a presentation. The first year was actually part of the dinner series, so we had a good 50 or so students come in and enjoy the dinner with us, and we actually went through exactly what we did and got them interested from the get-go, so they kind of had a heads up before they actually got on campus about what we were doing and how we could get involved going forward. So moving into the engagement piece of it, this is more the administration part, and this is something we have really already done, but we want to further develop it. So we just created this position, which is an IMAP hold. So we created that, but now we want to further develop that position. It is still kind of in limbo. We have certain things that we want the position to do, but with any position, it's going to take time to really develop it. Every day I figure out a new responsibility that I have, which is not always the most fun thing, but so we want to kind of standardize that. We also want to standardize our practices and figure out certain metrics for measuring just how culturally or inclusive are the things that we do, that our actions are. So over this break, we're gonna sit down and kind of devise a set of strategies. We're working with OEDI, with Regent Nelson Borough, and other individuals who are going to help us figure out what will be the best practices for making sure that our decisions, our actions, and our legislation really take into account all the different people that we impact. From that, the other engagement piece that we did for the is our new student assembly diversity affairs coalition, which takes the assembly, that was a big push, by the way, very difficult, that was quite to get passed. But that takes the student assembly into a realm we traditionally are not involved in, and that is academia. So essentially, this coalition is going to be responsible, it's comprised of key staff, which would be the college associates, as well as at least two student representatives from each of the colleges. That committee will oversee the implementation of each of the individual colleges and diversity initiatives and their menu items that they selected. So we'll take into account college-specific initiatives, but also we want to make sure that there's consistent implementation across the board. So for instance, if there's something that is working very well in the College of Engineering, the President of the United States, we know they're doing something right. What can we take from there and implement that into the College of Architecture and Planning? What would that look like? How feasible is that? Currently, there is no venue for students to be involved in a lot of the curriculum changes that happen. Sure, there are curriculum committees, like if you want, that students take part in, but they were not really involved in the process of creating a lot of these diversity initiatives. So that's kind of what we're going to do going forward with that part. The inclusion piece, that is more of an internal process. We're going to look at creating personal training and having more facilitative discussions without more of the difficult discussions that we really haven't sat down to have as a representative body. And that's probably why we've been lacking in a lot of the areas that we are in. So I would actually encourage all of you to kind of have the body sit down and really engage with each other in those discussions around race relations, ethnicity issues, gender, sex, gender identity, different things like that, because that really does impact the policies that you create. So we're going to really talk about that. I don't know if you guys were around last year during the last filing funding cycle, when CAP3, which is an Asian organization, applied for violent funding and wanted to break away from Alana. And the decision was not favorable of that. And the assembly was labeled as racist, and there were a lot of assembly members were not really willing or they were actually very afraid to speak their actual opinions because they didn't want to be confused as a racist in any way for withholding that funding for them. So kind of being able to have those difficult discussions and have an ongoing dialogue with what we're looking forward to on the assembly. And then finally, the treatment question. So for each of our representatives, we have different categories. So we have undesignated at-large representatives. We have representatives who are target constituencies. So that would be our college representatives, primarily our college representatives. They're their own. And then the last one would be the other target constituencies, which would be our LGBT liaison at-large, our minority representatives, international liaison, women's issues. For each of those categories, we want to create individual plans, action plans for them, so they know what resources are available for them in their particular colleges that they can take advantage of in order to better reach each of their constituencies in a more inclusive manner. For the other ones, it actually works just the same way. But since resources differ via colleges and based on what resources are available for the other targeted representatives, that's what we're kind of looking for. And that will be done in conjunction with Vice President of Internal Operations, who will oversee the bylaws or the charter related functions, as well as the other Vice President of Outreach. They will be responsible for a lot of those outreach strategies because they have their own set of requirements. They have their own decisions. I know it's kind of quick, but any questions over in the app?
Thank you, Ulysses. The speaker's list is now open for questions. Mitch?
You think that? Thank you for that. I haven't had a chance to in-depth to read what you sent me, but this is a great intro. Do you think that this is a useful exercise for the other assemblies?
I do. I think something I think you should know this. I almost said that. From a planning perspective, being in a department with I know what I'm saying is the story building. And I think, for example, when we talk about education policy, when we look at how legislators are very quick to try to create certain education policies, but they're very disconnected from the classroom experience. They've never taught, they've never been in there. So as representatives, you all have an obligation to be engaged and involved and in tune with what your constituents are dealing with, what they're facing, what their demographics are, those issues. And in order for them to understand their issues, you need to understand them as people. So when we talk about diversity, just as an umbrella, when we boil it all down, we can define it in terms of organizational goals that we have or what have you, but when we boil it down, the basis is different. So we need to be able to talk about those differences. But then moving past it, we have to talk about inclusion, we have to talk about identity formation, we have to talk about engagement, those kinds of things. So I do think it would be useful for each of these bodies, for each of our assemblies to actually sit down, come up with some sort of action plan to kind of better prepare yourself for doing the policy.
Yeah, thanks. As I think I've explained to you and to this body, the graduate professional student assembly is working on the graduate community initiative. One particular component of the GCI is the topic area of diversity and international students. And as you were talking just now, I really thought that in the way, because we haven't really developed a strategy for how exactly we're going to present that particular section, or really any of the sections. And I think that fitting in with the model of what you guys have done under the student assembly might be good for us so that we have something that's comparable that you can reference with the student assembly and that we can reference as, you know, part of the broader, student-based shared governance. So thanks for the inspiration.
Thank you so much. Any other further questions? Any further questions? Okay, thank you so much for being here today. Next we have Hugh John Wang, Vice President of Facility Services, who will give us a short presentation on his department and as well as questions.
Karen has agreed to come in talk a little bit about what they do. And then we have the rest of the campus, which is what we call the IPW campus, and we do that walkthrough. So the police is really part of that. We have people from facilities, as I said. We also have people from grounds and interested parties. So a lot of very frequently students will be part of the campus life, the student academic services walkthrough. Students could also be part of the academic walkthrough if there's a student who's particularly interested in telling us about certain areas that we need to work on. So we do that, and based on that walkthrough, we develop a list of deficiencies that we identify, and most of the deficiencies are things that we can manage and take care of. For instance, we might have an overgrown tree that gets in the way and blocks light from shining into certain areas. Those are easy things that we can fix. We can put in a ticket and somebody will go out and cut the trees down or cut the limb down at the tree to not block the light. Or if a lamp is out, we'll send somebody out and replace the lamp. So those are the easy things, and we take care of that fairly quickly following the walkthrough. Then there are the other areas that, for whatever reason, we've either been negligent or we haven't thought about it, or we find new areas. It's a big campus. We're always finding new areas that need to be lit. And those will be more difficult, more challenging because of the cost associated with it. So the question about how do we fund these things? We fund lighting deficiencies in the same way that we fund everything else. This is considered a maintenance issue, we have a list of a very long list of maintenance priorities, and all our maintenance, all our annual needs get prioritized in a certain way. Some things are more important than others, and those that are more important we get looked at before those that are less important. And so we go through that process, and I said earlier, we always try to address those projects that are deemed safety related, and we try to do that. And so we don't have a special pot of money set aside just for lighting projects. We don't have the university giving us a special pot of money just to take care of lighting projects. Or at least that's the way we have been operating. And then, on the side of student academic services, Karen goes through a very similar process. And Karen actually would fund whatever projects that are identified during the student academic services process. So she would fund that. So it's a very similar process. This year, based on the walkthrough that was just completed, I know that we identified, what we do is we come up with a list, as I said, we take care of the low-hanging fruit, and then whatever's left over, we work very closely with the police, and the police will actually engage in prioritizing these things, and they'll say, well, these are the 4 or 5 most urgent critical projects that we should try to find funding for. And this year, we've come up with such a list. And I know that I have this right here. So the 4 projects that came out of this year's walkthrough in the academic side is Space Science Parking Lot, the southwest corner of Big Red Barn, Kimball Thurston Barge Parking Lot, and on Maple Avenue North Side between Pine Tree and Vegetable Cross Walkway. So those are the 4 areas that the group that went around the walkthrough has deemed to be the most urgent. And so what we do is we try to find money to fix those deficiencies. And what we're going to do is we are going to take care of the first 2 items that I just mentioned, the Space Science Parking Lot and the corner of the southwest corner of the Big Red Barn. Kimball Thurston Bar Parking Lot, we're going to take care of that at the next fiscal year, meaning the year that starts on July 1. And Maple Ave North Side, is probably also going to be next fiscal year, but this is more complicated because Maple Avenue is part of the town of Ithaca, and we have to work, you know, through the town. We can't just go in and take care of these things on our own. So we're going to try and do that. Moving forward, what we hope to do is identify. We're requesting the university to fund a special amount of money just for some care rights. And we're hopeful that the university will fund that. We're actually going through that process right now of funding for fiscal 13. And in fact, I just came from that, a meeting at Day Hall to discuss the funding for fiscal 13. And, you know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the university will give us some amount of money to dedicate towards lighting projects. Even if we don't get that money, I know that from a priority standpoint, we do want to devote a portion of the maintenance funding that we do get for lighting. Just as an aside, you know, my maintenance funding has dropped by about 31-32% over the last 3 years, and that's a fact. And so I have that much less money today than I did 3 years ago. Take care of these things. But as I said, you know, safety is a number one concern. So that's what we're going to do. A question was also raised about the AQUAD. What I understand, there was some concern about the AQUAD. So the short term is that I know the construction work that's occurring over at Warren Hall is address some of the issues. I know there were some trees in the way. But the long-term look on the AQUAD is that the Warren Hall project has in its budget the lighting of at least the eastern half of the AQUAD. So this, you know, usually the landscape is really the last piece that goes in on the project. And so we're looking at the summer of 2015 before that project is fully completed. It's a two-phase project, but I know that's kind of a long way out, so we, you know, we're going to continue to monitor the AQUAD, and if we do have to pull some wall packs up to light a certain area, we're going to do that, but we do have a long-term fix, at least on the eastern half of the AQUAD. As far as the western half of the AQUAD, I know Cal has a long-term goal of really renovating the entire AQUAD at some point in the future. And I know that's several years down the road. Probably, you know, many of us won't even be around to experience that. But at least there's a plan to do that. But, you know, again, I think the important message I want to leave here today is that lighting is a priority, safety is a priority, and if there are any concerns about any area of campus, let us know. And you know, most of these lighting issues are not, you know, $100,000 projects. They're minor compared to the lot of stuff that we take care of. So I welcome, you know, any suggestions that you have, and we'll certainly take a look at it.
I'd like to add, when we do our walkthrough, this is the second year in a row where we've actually done it on the assessment day in collaboration with facility services. So we have a police officer riding around with the facility services engineer and campus life or SAS facility staff and students. We really are reach out to students to get their perspective, and I don't know if anybody saw the mass publication that went out, but it was the largest publication I've seen announcing the lighting walkthrough. But one of the areas that we find consistently is an issue is the area from, say, more of the non-campus residential unit area, so the off-campus housing area to central campus or to campus housing area. And those, they always seem to raise concerns, particularly from a student perspective, and I don't disagree with that. But those areas are incredibly sensitive because they're typically not university properties, and it's either the town or the city that we have to negotiate with to get the land use in place. So I think, you know, just awareness from that component is helpful, because we don't want to be seen that we're not working with the city or the town to get the land use, but their process is much slower if you don't have the control over things to be here. And I'm with you. I mean, our safety is
sorry. Okay, the speaker list is going to have Bridget, Mitch, and then Gregory.
Thank you, Gregory, for coming. I'm the chair of the infrastructure committee this year. I'm going to participate in the lighting program. This is a for the campus life. We're the chair, and one of the things that came up is, again, the funding, and I appreciate you coming and explaining that. And it's encouraged to hear that they are planning to create the lighting out of their own budget and have that as a separate item. Because it seemed like there was items that were on the list this year and maybe aren't getting addressed. Maybe you're just out of reach. I don't know. But you're saying that you're going to be addressing four items. Out of the list of how many
suggestions
do you have? Quite a few, correct?
Quite a few, yeah. I mean, I have a list here, but
I just want to see if the slide
that's in. So I'm wondering if there's anything that the assembly can do to help support your efforts and, you know, make it known that we're really looking for more support budget-wise to get these in.
Yeah, I think it would be good for me to have had this meeting because we are in budget conversations right now with the university's budget office. And for me to relay this meeting, the information that's following this meeting back to that group who's determining our budget, I think we could certainly go a long way towards their ability or desire to fund this lighting fund. It's a big pot of money. You know, we're asking for, you know, $40 million, but that's a lot more than we had before. And you know, for me to take $250 million out of my own already 31% cut budget, you know, I just won't be able to do that. You know, if I don't get that pot of money, then I would have to carve a little bit out of my own budget, but it won't be that same amount. And so I think that. I think it's good that we're having this conversation right now. It's timely, and I hope that the university will come to realize that this is an important thing that we need to worry about. You know, it's like the funding we came up with George Safety.
Mm-hmm.
That's again, that's a safety thing. And because of that, somehow we found the money to do it. And we're doing it, and we get a chance to go down there and take a look at some of the things that we put up. And the trails today are much safer than ever been because of that. And so I think this is kind of in that same ballpark. You know, we want to address the lights, we want to address the deficiencies, and hopefully we'll get it done.
We have another component to that too. And I know that SAS is working with some facilities to really determine what is the appropriate safety lighting standard that we should be looking at. And so that committee's working. But also another component of it too is we don't want to overlight the community. I mean, you don't want Cornell to turn into this giant beacon that you can see from 20 miles out of town. We want to be safe, but we also want to be sustainable, and we want to be respectful to the night environment. You know, personally, I would like to look up the city stars, and that's what we just do now. And I know Kiani is in several situations where people have actually come forward and said, oh, we need to put up this new building, and the lights are too bright. right, and it's and, you know, so it's kind of a balance, and also just because a student chooses to take a shorter path to campus, it might not be lived with, but it's not the safest. They should be using public streets where they're lit and where we know they can be safer. I don't want to say everybody can be safe all the time. But that's another concern that we've been trying to look at, because we have so much of the students going from remote areas to campus, and we can't light them all. And that's a concern that we try to balance as well. But we do, on the safety of the one, we're charged with taking care of people's children.
Thank you. Mitch?
Thank you both for coming. You know, as the president of the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, at the end of your comments, you mentioned that kind of the lighting and safety concerns with the campus fringe. And for me representing graduate students, that's a top priority of mine, because almost 90% of my population has to pass that campus fringe to go home. And there are some particular areas of concern, and the reason why I'm interested in it and bringing it up further is because I think the CPSA and the SA are engaging in some local government advocacy, and safety issues are definitely on that priority list. And so I think we definitely like to work with you. I know that community relations is a delicate topic and not one that's usually dealt with by any particular entity of campus, although we can do kind of whatever we want, to a certain extent, which is good. And so I think that we want to make sure that we can be a part of the discussion, so that we can very effectively advocate for appropriate things when we go meet with folks in the city. I know that at the beginning of the semester, with the amount of significant events along University Avenue, especially University Avenue from kind of the bottom where it connects with Wall Creek up to, I think, Lake Street, if I'm remembering my street name correctly, an area where a lot of graduate professional students live, and it's an area that I use almost on a daily basis. And I don't feel like they're walking down past a certain point. No, down towards Wall Creek, towards Court Street.
Okay.
But anyways, and so I reached out to the mayor and said, you know, this is an area of concern. It's a very poorly lit place. I'm in city planning, so I'm somewhat familiar with the standards that have been set on streets and facilities. And, so anyways, we're pursuing that dialogue with local government on safety, amongst other issues, including transportation, which I know is a piece of facilities. And so we just want to make sure that we can address you and continue that effort.
You know, I think, too, from that standpoint, is your main liaison is, and anything that comes to him that affects the helping plan that he gives to me. And, you know, I'd be interested in those conversations because you have them as well. No, I appreciate your willingness.
And the other thing is, you know, if you do have these city-related issues, you know, we can advocate for you, even though it might be totally on city property and it's their responsibility. You know, we can still, I mean, I know the mayor really well. I meet with him on a regular basis. And, you know, I think we can advocate for you. So if you let us know about it,
and the graduate properties are included in Washington. The Cornell graduate properties.
Okay. I would just like to ask the last call on the speakers list. Bob, anyone else? All right, on the speakers list will be Greg, Liz, myself, and Bob, and that will be the end. So, Greg.
Okay. Thanks all for coming. I think it's important work that you both do, so thank you. My one question is, of the list of the 20-some items or whatever it might be that aren't high need or urgent priorities, what happens to those, and how do we work over time to get them off the list? Or do they just, do we wait till next year till those, you know, number five then becomes number one once one and four are knocked out? What happens to those?
Well, I think it's no different from any of the lists that we have on things that we just can't take care of, right? There, you know, we have a list of, you know, under deferred maintenance, you know, we can only take care of the top 20%. So, what do you do with number 21? Are they not as important? Sure, they're important. You just can't get to it. So at some point, you just can't address everything. And so you do your best to take care of what's considered the most urgent and most critical. And I believe that, you know, based on the most recent lawsuit, you know, those are the four projects that we identified as the most critical. Does that mean that we ignore one through whatever? No. I think that, you know, for the first time, we, you know, because of the conversation that ensued out of this here, you know, we're hopeful that we'll have a little bit of money to address. And I believe that if the university does come through with the funding, we could probably take care of a good chunk of that. I'm not going to sit and say we can take care of all 26, but, you know, I believe that you know, we can take care of a good chunk of that. And I believe that if we do take care of a good chunk of that, many of the, or if not all of the most critical areas would be addressed. So I'm hopeful of that, even if we don't get that money and, you know, we do set aside more than we have in the past relating projects, I believe we would really take care of the most critical needs first. And, you know, it's like parents said, we'll never be able to fully convert this campus into a completely safe environment. As hard as we try to do, you know, there are going to be areas that are deficient. And, you know, that's why we do these walkthroughs. Because, you know, we might have missed something, or, you know, some area that might be critical one year may not be as critical another year because, you know, traffic patterns have changed or whatever, you know, or maybe there's a construction project that went up nearby that took care of the problem, right? Sometimes, you know, those things do happen. So I think the important thing is, you know, to have these annual walkthroughs and continue to alert us to areas that anyone feels is unsafe. And we'll look at it, and if we do in fact agree with that, and if it's not an exorbitant amount of money, we'll try to end up taking care of it.
Liz? Well, again, I'd like to echo, thank you so much for coming. I know that it's clear that we're all really benefiting from this sort of a conversation. My question is most specifically towards resources that the community can utilize to work with facilities. You've mentioned the walkthroughs, and I just wanted to know your thoughts on whether that was the most efficient test, or if there are other ways to communicate with the broader campus community. Through, I don't know, a form on your website, a campaign that you're running for creating this sort of a sense of a safe campus.
Well, I think that, I think groups such as these is a good venue to bring this up. This is the University of Central, and you represent, you know, all three constituents of Cornell. And
four.
Sorry. And you brought that up, and that's exactly what we want. We used to do. There was a time when we used to do two walks a year, right? way back when, before the financial crisis, and we had more people on our staff. And now we're down to one, right? So might we go back to two officers? Perhaps someday, hopefully, our staff has been cut. We lost, in my area, we lost about 16% of my staff in the last few years. So we have less people doing equal or maybe in some areas, some cases more work. And so, we have to be judicious not, from the time we spend on doing certain things. But, I think the ones that you walk through are going to continue. And I think it's just word of mouth, and I think safety is all, as the last year, everything related to safety has been magnified, because of what's happening with the accidents that occurred in the gorge and some of the unfortunate incidents that have occurred, in the beginning of this academic year. And so that's been magnified, and because of that, people are talking more about it, and because people are talking about it, it's now brought to people's, my work, my attention. And we're now trying to get money from the university to take care of something that we never thought about doing, a year ago. So this is a good thing. And I encourage you to keep doing it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Wayne, thank you so much for being here again. My question is, about the overlighting of some of the buildings on campus. I've heard a lot of people say that a lot of the buildings have lights that are on all night long, even though the buildings are locked, and et cetera, or excess emergency lighting and such. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, that's a question that I get asked all the time. That's a problem. I'm gonna admit it right now. It's a problem that buildings are lit when they're not used. In some cases, buildings that might look like they're not occupied might actually be occupied. So we don't really know, but I say more often than not, lights are left on and there's nothing we can do about it. So what we're doing is we actually have we're engaged in a campus energy conservation initiative, and we actually have people, we've engaged the students to walk around and turn off lights in buildings, and that program is continuing during the school year, and it's been very successful. We're smarter when we design buildings so that the lights are on type sensors, so that when nobody's occupying the building, the lights will actually go off. But at the end of the day, individual offices in buildings are controlled by whoever the room is assigned to. We can't force people to turn the lights off. And if that person who occupies that office doesn't see fit to turn the lights off when they leave the office, the lights are going to stay on, unfortunately. And so, we're doing a lot of education right now. We have a person who goes around and meets with people and with different faculty groups and staff groups to educate them about the importance of turning off lights. Those are the little things that we try and do as much as we can as part of the Energy Conservation Initiative. We could probably do more, but we do as much as we can with the staff that we have. And we just have to get the word out to people to turn off the lights when they leave. And hopefully someday the message will get through.
If I can put in a little plug from the Energy Conservation Group. A little sticker that they will give you that you can put on your computer, you can put on your light switches, that they turn me off when you're not using. And they have rolls and rolls and rolls of them.
The biggest complaint I get is, over at the stadium.
Yeah.
Right? The stadium lights are on and nobody's on the field practicing. We don't control those lights. We really don't. And those are turned off by whoever runs the field, the flag field, And sometimes they're on timers, and sometimes they cancel practice, or it gets done early and the lights are still on. So it's frustrating. It really is.
Just spray paint the field, turn the lights off. forget Cornell.
But we do remind the coaches, we remind the equipment people frequently. And you're right, a lot of it is behavioral and any type of publication, mention it. Hughes Group was a phenomenal educational lab here in the next couple of weeks about intercession. When we're closed, turn off your lights, turn off your computer, turn off your printer, turn down the heat, be aware. So I think your guys do a really good job. And they try to do the best.
Thank you.
The stickers are great.
I got a roll of them. Bob,
you have a question? Yeah, just a comment about when it's dark. There are many people that are working in the building, like I work, for instance. And so it just is not true that after hours that there's no one there. Graduate students in particular.
We don't usually have light. We don't have windows usually.
Right. Good.
A lot of
below ground, yeah.
The building care can
but that's actually not what I was going to ask. I was going to ask how, in the list, I noticed that the Thurston Bar Kimball parking lot, that happens to be where I park actually. And it's on the perimeter. It's next to College Track. So the police probably have a better idea of where the crime is occurring than anyone in the room, actually. And so being on the walkthrough, I'm sure they're cognizant of where things are happening. Publicizing that might be one way to mitigate against some risky behavior having to do with that particular area. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware that there's any crime been done in that parking lot, actually. Again, having parked there for 30 years, I didn't even lock my car. Now, maybe that's a bad idea. But you know what? You laugh. Okay. I'm just saying that's a behavior that can be quickly changed. Mm-hmm. But so far, no. Mm-hmm. So how much is that list, though, prioritized having to do with crime and things?
I think that factors into it, certainly. And like you said, I think the police, we don't know where this crime is. The police are aware of that. Prioritizing on the list is really done by the police. They're in the walkthrough, and they actually tell us these are the areas that you need to be in.
Yeah, that's right. So you mentioned how people feel when they walk. Well, obviously, if it's a totally unlit area, for instance, in that parking lot, if you go by Ward Lair on the Gorge side, you're on your own there.
Right.
But it's how you feel, but it's also the facts of the matter. And I'm glad that the police really are part of that because, having someone be safe and not be safe is another problem. Mm-hmm. Right? It goes both ways. So there's some facts, and I'm glad that it's being looked at in terms of incidents as well as in terms of feeling.
Alright, that is the end of the speaker list. Thank you so much for being here, you two. Thank you for taking all of our questions, and I hope you guys have a great day.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're going to have a late addition to the agenda. We're going to stick, Jake, we're going to
add Jake Reich, close, in to discuss a little about the Green Revolving Fund, which is something the Infrastructure Committee has been working on. So if you could just give us a brief description of
the motion.
Yes.
Considering the time that it is now,
mm-hmm.
might I suggest that this is the last item on the agenda and we table the discussion of committee appointments to the next meeting in January? Just in the interest of ending on time and providing Jake with enough space to talk.
And second? Anybody
oppose?
I always lose that word. Oppose the motion? I hear none. Jake, you will be the last person on the agenda, and we will table the discussion of committee appointment system until the January meeting. Jake?
Beyond the Green Revolving Fund is the $1 billion Green Challenge, which is a collaboration of Green Revolving Fund, and it's organized by the Sustainable Endowments Institute, which is a nonprofit in Cambridge, Massachusetts, engaging in research in energy efficiency at universities. And what they do is they support these Green Revolving Funds and help universities to maintain them. And they also offer you software. Every university that's part of the $1 billion Green Challenge is the software for tracking all the projects, all the energy savings, excuse me, carbon data, anything that you really want to organize by. It's very flexible. And then you can also search through a library of all the available projects that other universities are using. You can speak with other universities about how this works out for them. And it's a way of engaging the broader community in this initiative of capturing financial savings through energy conservation. So I guess there's a lot to this, and at this point we're working on getting more support and integrating this into the current initiative. And with the new budgeting model next year, where the departments will be responsible for utilities, this could be a great way of allowing departments who have high utility costs to make investments, because they could, you know, the account would issue them a loan to implement the project. And then, you know, the savings would go back to pay the project back with interest if necessary, and the rest of the savings go to that utility.
Thank you, Jake. Bridget, do you want to tell us a little bit about how the infrastructure is working with the Infrastructure Committee is working with Jake?
Well, we just met last night, but wasn't really too sure what she was going to be discussing today, but
mm-hmm.
it seemed like it was all centered around the lighting and mainly, it's trying to work with this group and find out how we can try to move beyond support. We've met, the group has met, there are lots of people who support this idea, but it needs to then go into some kind of action. Right?
Yes.
How do we get the funding and we're talking about at least $1 million seed money to fund the revolving. So where do you cut? How does that get approached? How do you get action where we have support, but there's no action? Then let's do that.
Time to reach in.
Sorry.
Kind of called an alumni.
Well, that's not, you know,
I'm kidding. Greg?
My question is, you know, of that $1 million seed money, what sort of project can that fund? I know the hotel just, you know, we went through with our HVAC system and did a whole energy conservation process where we put motion source fund, and what sort of impact is it going to have until it gets to be, you know, a multi-million-dollar fund where we're, you know, overhauling some of these old buildings and really making a huge difference.
So some of that would be up to facilities and how they want to work with this. And the way the Green Revolving Fund works is it's very flexible. And some universities fund it out of their endowment, out of cash reserves, operating budget, wherever makes most sense for that university. And some of the universities have $50,000 projects or account for investing because that's what makes sense for them. And in order to join the $1 billion Green Challenge, where you get the software and you get the collaboration and you get access to all the other projects, it has to be a minimum of 1% of the university's endowment or $1 million. And for Cornell,
take the million.
The project with $1 million, you know, you wouldn't be talking full building retrofits. And that's something that would get worked out in facilities because there already is a large pool of money in the energy conservation initiative. And this would be more so of high return projects that are smaller scale and haven't been addressed. Speaking on the hotel school, one of the projects we evaluated this semester was our student organization, which is Energy Corps, which is kind of working with this project, is right outside of the auditorium. Our 70 watt incandescent light bulbs, over 120 of them, and they're on between 18 and 20 hours a day, and they have an average life of about 3,000 hours, and you can switch those out for LED lights that, or CFLs that, you know, have 5-10 times greater lifespan and use an eighth of the energy. And we, you know, in evaluating those investments, that's paying itself off in less than 3 months, and then the rest is all just savings. So it's like allowing those kind of projects to really surface.
Sure.
And we have a 25-person group that's really interested in supporting this initiative and managing these types of projects. So not only would, you know, we, you know, create this fund and have, you know, the ability to issue loans, but we would have a student group associated with the fund that would be an intermediary to, you know, getting things done. So it would depend on what projects we actually want to get done when, you know, you create the fund, but definitely can't do building retrofits for $1 million.
Sure.
Harvard has a $12 million fund, and they do some retrofits.
And that's not even a true sound of their endowment.
And then the other question is, how does the energy conservation incentive, you know, is this small potatoes to that? I mean, that's $42 million that the university is already working on with energy and sustainability. And also, is that just a short-term 5-year incentive? And this would be an ongoing incentive? Trying to weigh out some of that.
Peter?
So I have two questions for you. The first is, I'm with the students, and they've heard this a few times. So I've been thinking, and I've looked up the software that you're talking about. And this software, I don't understand why this piece of software is so important when we have people that do finance and can determine the returns on the incandescent bulbs, and why do we need to start with that seed money. I understand, you know, you be affiliating yourself with this $1 million challenge, but can't we start a little smaller, work up to $1 million, and then join it that way?
Yeah, so that is an option, and a lot of the parts of the software are pretty basic, and it's just return on investment. And then there's more complicated parts of the software, like enabling different account users to have different visibility in there. So you could potentially allow all students to access this account and say, oh, wow, these are the projects that are going on. And that gets back to some of the behavioral change stuff, too. But, you know, as far as starting a smaller project fund, that could be possible and lead up to that. But when you dedicate yourself to $1 billion in challenge, the maximum financial commitment you make is $2,500. Administrative, you pay a 0.05% administrative fee capped at $2,500 annually. And they help you with implementation, and you get access to the other schools who are doing these funds. So if you're committing to this challenge, you could call up whoever's doing the Green Revolving Fund at any other university that probably you want to call the one that's got the most similar structure to Cornell. I don't know if that exists, but you can make that happen with dedicating to the Green Revolving or to the $3 billion challenge.
And then a response. I don't see why we need that software to call with the university, because I know that's a common practice that I use with the student assembly, determining other things. I'll pick up the phone, I'll find an email address, and ask, hey, what do you guys do? I don't see why, I mean, I've done things in collaboration with another university regarding my role as an RA, just asking their residential program department to just email them or call them. And I just need a software to do that. So I just don't see like why this piece of software is so amazing that we need to dedicate this $1 million now. And then on my second question is more geared toward what happens in 10 years with this Green Revolving Fund when we reach that point where we don't, where the fund can't make investments. So now you're sitting on this large sum of money, and the next piece of green technology costs more than what's in the fund. So then we just have this pool of money for what?
Okay, so to the first question, the software has a ton of features that I haven't even touched on. One of the main things I think I did is the project library. You can go through and you know, see exactly what's going on with all the project data. And there's a lot of benefits, and the only cost is the maximum $2,500. You also get the PR associated with joining the $1 billion Green Challenge, seeing as four of the other IBs have already committed to it, and there's $112 million in Green Revolving Funds. As far as what would we do if we don't have, so the question, what would we do if we don't have the money to invest in the next technology, or is the question, what do we do if we kind of run out of projects to fund?
I think they're the same question.
Okay, well, I mean, if it's whether we have enough for the next piece of technology, that would be, we would have, that would be with facilities budget, would they have enough money to kick in to, get us there? If we are running out of projects, that's a different story in the way I'm thinking of it, because then I would think you would more want to use it for community engagement and behavioral change aspects that may not have the exact amount of savings, but I understand
you. I could see the potential of this revolving fund to just be a pot of money eventually. And I could see that happening sooner rather than later.
There's always going to be some way to save. I mean, that's diversifying your investment strategy. It's to diversify in short-term, long-term, medium-term. So you're doing big projects, complete building overhauls. We're always going to have old buildings at Cornell. So at some point, we're going to need to retrofit some of these older halls with newer technology, which costs millions and millions of dollars. So I doubt that there's ever going to be a pool of money just sitting at Cornell. It doesn't seem like that makes sense. And it's up to the fund manager to make sure that they're diversifying their investments across these different sort of initiatives. A short-term fix is light bulbs. A long-term fix is a complete new HVAC system and windows that, pay themselves off over 20 years. So I think it's a little short-sighted to think that we're going to run out of opportunities to improve green technology in the short term.
And I understand what you're saying, and I'm more coming from the perspective of now that individual departments will be looking at the utilities, that type of aspect of it and determining whether or not they know how much money they're guaranteed or eligible for the Green Revolving Fund for them to have a loan there. Do you kind of see where I have? So, you know, like, let's say ags, as an ag school, let's say particular department, Dyson, right? What entitlement does Dyson have to this fund if they wanted to use money from it, as opposed to another department, and making that clear? And is it something that has to apply for? Is it going to be something that...
I think this conversation is more getting into the details of the project, and if you wish to discuss with Jake later, I'm sure Jake will give you his information. We have other speakers on the list, so we're going to move on. Liz?
So my question is, you're working with the infrastructure committee about this, right? Is there, because clearly this is a new concept for me, this Green Revolving Fund. It sounds very interesting. Do you have just a website or something, of somewhere that we could go and find more information and maybe send that out to the other assemblies?
Yeah, greenbillion.org. They have the resources.
Okay.
and they actually have a comprehensive report of all the other schools that are doing this, case studies, and return on investment analysis of particular projects.
Great, thank you.
All right, any further questions? Thank you, Jay.
Well, no. I think I can make, I don't know if it would be a point of privilege, but whatever. I just thought it would be helpful to recap the process by which the Assembly makes recommendations, because it sounds like there's a resolution in there. I'm not quite sure what the details would be, but basically if you work with someone who's interested in this, who's a voting member of the Assembly, and we have quite a few around the table here, to develop a concrete proposal that can be brought to the Assembly in the form of a resolution, then either the Assembly can discuss that directly and possibly adopt it, or depending on the details of it, it may be reviewed by a committee first and then brought back here. So if there's, I just thought it would be helpful to know that that follow-up with a resolution and a concrete recommendation that the Assembly can endorse and send on to President Scorton is probably the way this Assembly can be most helpful in advancing a proposal.
All right. Thank you, Jake, for being here today. We hope the university could work with you more on this project. Thank you. We are going to, adopt the minutes. And approve. Sorry, I read that wrong. Sorry. We're going to approve the minutes from the last meeting and minutes later, as opposed to tabling the approval of the minutes until the next meeting. So, the minutes for the meeting on November 13th have been distributed to you. Is there any amendments to the minutes?
What about Randy?
I wanted to clarify about,
yeah,
it's possible to adopt the minutes and then amend them at the next meeting. If they're not adopted at all, that makes it difficult for us to publish them. And since the next UA meeting isn't going to be until late January, that's a long time to avoid publishing them just because there's one extra piece that needs to be added.
So, anybody opposing approving the minutes for November 13th? I hear no opposition. The minutes for the meeting on November 13th has been approved. I motion to adjourn the meeting. Open discussion. Floor is open.
Okay, so I'd like to just point out that the various people that we had come in today to talk to us, these are very clear examples about why we need functioning committees. And our current committees are still lacking a significant portion of their membership. So over the break, I'd really appreciate if we could all sit back and think about ways to effectively staff our committees, staff the UA, staff our assemblies. And if we can come in and just brainstorm together. I think one of them is that the September deadline is ineffective. Ned can't really just arbitrarily draw people out of the sky and plop them on committees. And as much as I'm sure you'd love to be able to do that. In any case, we need to either think of some concrete way of making that deadline doable, or we need
the five representatives from the region that Cornell is in talk about the budget sequestration and the effect that it could have and the budget deal could have on higher education, specifically with regard to graduate professional students. So we'll definitely have a report for you probably in January, but if you're interested in hearing more about what we talked about with the various senators and congresspeople, definitely let me know. We're excited for it. I think you're as excited as I am. Advocacy is my background, so I'm really excited to do this and represent the community. I know that David Thornton had an open letter with yesterday, I think it was. And I think that President Thornton set it down for DC next week. So it's a good time period for all these things to fall into place.
If you guys haven't read it, you should. I mean, it's very well written. David and Glenn, I think it was, I saw it in Forbes,
yeah.
And a Forbes alert that I get.
It was an open letter basically saying, you know, a directive to President Obama that the facility campaign pledges on supporting higher education and maintaining the funding and programmatic support.
And he called him out on, he called him out on very specific topics that he went through. It's really interesting. So, see if we can find a copy and float it around somehow.
Yeah.
Sure. We're going to continue with reports now that you remind me of that.
Sorry, it's right on Forbes. You can just
type it in.
Yeah.
If you want to send it to the
sorry.
Is anybody from the student assembly willing to give a report?
So, we didn't meet last week, Thanksgiving. Everybody had a nice Thanksgiving? but tomorrow and Thursday and Friday will be our final student assembly meetings for the semester. We'll be approving election rules and not much more.
Anybody from the employee assembly?
Yeah. I can just give a brief update. We haven't met since our last meeting, so there's nothing to report there, but we did conclude the employee care fund auction and hope to get the final numbers in. It was all online this year for the first time and was well, I believe, a lot of participation. Unfortunately, there were some issues with the online auction site itself, and people were having difficulties, but we're hoping that it didn't slow people down and that we were able to raise a fair amount of money for the employee care fund. So that's it.
And lastly, Faculty, anybody?
Yeah, I was there. I'm just looking over some of the PowerPoint, which are online, actually. But there was a discussion, or actually a presentation by Mary Oppenheimer, and about her department and what they do. So that's summary kind of thing. New material there. There was a USC University Faculty Committee resolution amending the Cornell agreement, and this has to do with MOOCs and all that other things.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out badly for the committee, in that it was sent back to them. And it seems to be a rather innocuous kind of thing, because the original eCornell agreement said that eCornell is not allowed to participate in degree-granting courses, which kind of cuts them out of a lot of activities, such as the program that was outlined to get Human Resources degree program approved, they're going to propose to use eCornell. And so the failure to pass this one meant that this one was moved, actually. So what the deal was is that there are a number of other vendors who can be used to do what eCornell would have done, but in fact, the initial agreement seems to be murky enough that people were saying, what is this mentioned agreement, the support services agreement, what's that all about? So there was a lot of back and forth, and this happens every now and then, and it resulted in it being sent back to the committee for clarification and save time, because the succeeding resolution from the Educational Policy Committee couldn't be done because it requires approval of these Cornell student events. So that was kind of a half an hour rest.
Thank you, Bob. Any further points? I move to adjourn the meeting. Second. I adjourn the meeting at 5:54 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.